The following points are often left out of discussions of the ego death theory. The theme of affirming yet transcending determinism in religion and myth is typically, basically always left out of discussions of the ego death theory, because the rest of the modern approach to philosophy, modern era approach to philosophy, just doesn't really have the concept of affirming determinism at the same time as transcending determinism. In fact, it doesn't really have the concept of transcending determinism. You either are supposed to be a free will advocate or a determinism advocate, whether that determinism is conceived as modern era sequential determinism or all at once timeless determinism. You're supposed to pick either version of determinism and then free will. Now, compatibilism, they often talk about. You could really make the case that the ego death theory holds a version of compatibilism, but it's such a completely different version of compatibilism than is expressed in any of the modern era philosophy books that it would really be, frankly, completely misleading to label the ego death theory as compatibilism. It really needs almost its own category that's... Now, there's the usual cliché versions of modern era philosophical determinism versus free will, where determinism is generally always, according to typical ways of thinking, it's always interpreted as sequential determinism, where the future doesn't exist yet, God creates the first state of things, and then that state of things, then as time progresses, that state of things causes the next state, which causes the next state. There's only recently been a decent formulation of tenseless time, and Rudy Rucker's block universe, time is a space. It's particularly what's probably the most important catchphrase for recent thinking on this is time as a space-like dimension. That, I think, gets the essence a lot more than tenseless time, because the phrase tenseless time alluding to linguistic philosophy, which I, as important as semantics is, I think that linguistic philosophy is just misleading more than anything. More to the point, and practically and relevantly, is the concept of time as a space-like dimension, which is fully compatible with this idea of tenseless time. Any discussion of tenseless time pretty much inevitably becomes, anyway, a discussion of time as a space-like dimension. Because when anyone says, well, what the heck do you mean by tenseless time, by that phrase? Well, that means time as a space-like dimension. Oh, well, why didn't you say so? An example of transcending determinism, according to pre-modern religious mythology, is the theme of crossing the boundary of the sphere of the fixed stars into the highest of the three heavens in the three-heaven system. For all practical purposes, Copenhagenist interpretation of quantum mechanics equals the Bohr interpretation, that's B-O-H-R, equals the free will position. And no free will equals Einstein or Bohm equals hidden variables determinism. Things can be usefully, most simply, divided into two camps this way, as far as interpretation of modern era quantum mechanics, physics, and science. Max Freakout generalized that science is a pretty simple story as far as its position on determinism, that science holds a position of determinism. However, in popular thinking about physics and science, it's very common to run to quantum mechanics as a hiding place for free will and say that science supports free will because of quantum indeterminacy. It's hard to say how many scientists or what percentage of scientists and what percentage of philosophers of science adhere to that view. I would say that from what I've read of computer scientists and physicists that, well, it's really hard to say, but I want to say that most of them adhere to determinism. Richard Double's book Metaphilosophy highlights the contrasting motives and argumentation style of people who focus on the no free will view. Books advocating the no free will view are generally, as a rule, driven by the project and motive of it's important to protect free will and morality. People who write books advocating the no free will view, as a rule, are driven by the motive of getting at truth. Richard Double points out those two very different kinds of motives that cause people to pick up the pen and write these books on the two different views in the first place, which is what he means by metaphilosophy. He's stepping back a level and going, what motivates people to get into philosophy to advocate the no free will view or the free will view? There are two modern era versions of determinism that are relevant to recent science and philosophy: the sequential view, which is older, predominant, and familiar, and the holistic or timeless view, which is newer, strictly 20th century, and less well known. The question, what is the psychedelics perspective on free will versus determinism, is exactly identically the same as the question, what is the mysticism perspective on free will versus determinism? drug-free meditation is bunk, that is, it's unergonomic and historically inaccurate. Well, drug-free contemplation and mysticism is historically an incorrect assumption about the history of mysticism, that it was drug-free. Assuming a drug-free history of mysticism portrays a false historical picture that prevents the very primary religious experiencing that such religious studies presumably pursue. That's what I mean by saying that drug-free meditation or contemplation is bunk. It's unergonomic and it's historically inaccurate as far as what is the normal way historically, what was the historically normal way of in which mystics accessed the mystic altered state. Historically, mystics accessed the mystic altered state through drugs, not through drug-free contemplation or meditation, because that's the ergonomic way. Drug-free approaches aren't effective. They don't work. The exceptions prove the rule. The rule is that meditation without drugs accomplishes nothing. You can drag out counterexamples. They are so pathetic and statistically rare and involve such absurd, abnormal, bizarre, artificial practices as 30 years or 50 years of sitting around doing nothing, and that's if you're one of the people who happens to have that aptitude for causing an endogenous altered state release of chemicals inside the brain. It's really irrelevant. Our potential to cause the brain to release these chemicals and to enter the altered state is really irrelevant and in a freak show, bizarre side attraction. It's nothing but a footnote to the main, normal, feasible, viable, ergonomic approach of ingesting drugs, which is the historically by far the predominant approach. That's what I mean when I say that drug-free meditation and contemplation is bunk. It's a lie, it's a false lead, a dead end. Letcher's book, Shroom, was first published in the UK in 2006. It's a narrow book, it's bereft of theory. It does manifest and essentially effectively point out the weaknesses. It points out that the Wasson-Allegro-McKenna version of the entheogen theory of religion has vulnerabilities or weaknesses. Letcher comes along and plays on those vulnerabilities of that triangulated Wasson-Allegro-McKenna version of the entheogen theory of religion. The Christian Eucharist, throughout the duration of pre-modern Christian history, was understood as psychoactive plants. I continue to detect a strong Big Bang fallacy. This idea, like, to take it to an extreme, the Big Bang fallacy would be something like, Jesus came along as a historical individual, took mushrooms like Amanita once, and had a great experience, and that experience that he just that one time had was the foundation for all the rest of the religion that came after him, and that was the only time that drugs were used in the religion. That's sort of an extreme caricature of the Big Bang model of how religions have entheogenic origins. The opposite view amounts to something like saying that for an entire period, there was a uniform, heavy use of entheogens by everyone, not by these so-called founders that had some sort of monopoly on this rare, rare experience of entheogens. Beware of unconscious use or assumption of this Big Bang way of thinking about it, talking in terms of the experience of the founding figures. Who do you consider to be the founders of Christianity? According to a Big Bang way of thinking, it was Mr. Paul and Mr. Historical Paul and Mr. Historical Jesus that at the beginning had these great experiences that were then misinterpreted by everybody else, but they were the founders who originally had these entheogenic experiences, and their followers afterwards just tried to mimic and parrot and follow behind in their footsteps, trying to understand those experiences that only those founding figures had. Well, who are the actual founders of Christianity? It would be many people over many centuries. And all of them had normally and frequently used entheogenic mystic state experiences. The founders of Christianity amounts to countless thousands of people over many centuries. Those are the founders. So the whole concept or phrase of founders, more important than linguistic philosophy, is semantics as far as when you say the word founders of Christianity or founders of a religion, it implies this whole way of thinking. So that a single word implies this entire way of thinking and paradigm. The word founders implies the whole Big Bang conventional orthodox Eusebian model of Christian origins, the Big Bang view. It was an ongoing medium bang, an ongoing maximal bang, rather than a single point in time Big Bang. It was more like an ongoing Big Bang of constant use of these entheogens by countless people throughout many centuries. that was the origin of religion. It's much more smeared and much more distributed and democratic. Wasson was incorrect in dismissing the interpretation of the Plainkraut fresco as Amanita. His dismissal was comparable to flimsy entheogen diminishment strategies, per my Wasson article that I collaborated with Jan Irvin on. That is one of the points that needs more attention when people discuss the ego-death theory. Regarding entheogen diminishment strategies, always keep in mind the media filtering effect that's a result of prohibition. Filtering creates. You construct reality tunnels by filtering effects, by suppressing certain information but not suppressing other views, that constructs a whole world model. By obstructing scholars who would otherwise publish maximal entheogen views on religious history, by suppressing those voices, you're selectively building up. It's like this idea of selective evolution. You're developing and constructing one view by suppressing or killing off and censoring other competing views. The only view that's permitted by the establishment is to diminish entheogens, reluctantly admit that they work, grudgingly admit that, but spin and spin it to diminish them as much as possible. By censoring out other views, the establishment effectively, in effect, builds up and entrenches that view. Basically, to permit is to condone, is to construct. The establishment condones only one view, the entheogen diminishing view, thus constructing and condoning and building up and affirming that view. Only writings that diminish entheogens are permitted, practically, to make it into print. A scholar could publish a different view if they are allowed to by the publishers. But even if they were allowed to, then they'd catch hell for it. And the exceptions prove the rule again. There's Dan Mercure, an academic. Yeah, there's Benny Shannon, an academic. But look, they had to buy fully into the status quo for decades before they were permitted to come out and even address these topics of entheogens. As a result, there is, in effect, a prohibitively expensive tax or fine for scholarly writers if they wish to put forward a non-diminishing view. Now, if these scholars are rich, that is, in the sense of they're established and they have a lot of esteem in their field, then they, you might say metaphorically, then they can afford to pay the fine and tax in order to publish these things that otherwise they wouldn't be able to afford to. It would be career suicide, except that these guys are already established in their careers, so they can get away with it, but others can't. You can't start off writing Benny Shannon's book. You can't start off writing Dan Mercure's Psychedelics and Theogens books. You have to first start off producing well-respected other books that dance around the subject more, like Dan Mercure's book Gnosis, which is pretty diminishing of the entheogen view, that does raise it only to reject it, really, and baselessly reject it. The Gnostics, he says that the Gnostics, he argues that in the book Gnosis, before his Psychedelics Entheogens books, that the Gnostics must not have used entheogens because entheogens are physical plant material and the Gnostics were against the physical world. That's a rubbish argument. The Gnostics were not simply and literally against the physical world. But by his reasoning, you would say that Gnostics never ate any food or drank any water because that's material, which is, of course, nonsense. Really shoddy argument, shockingly shoddy argument coming from Dan Mercure there. How can someone smart enough to write this thick, good book on Gnosis write such absurd reasoning that you have to ask, is he trying to pull our leg here and secretly winking at us by putting forth such a comically, sickly absurd argumentation? These entheogen diminishment fallacies became popular starting on the day LSD was made illegal. You could correlate that and see these diminishment statements appearing in print heavily right around the time LSD was made, right just after LSD was made illegal, October 6, 1966, in the U.S. Society found itself confronted with a choice, as laid out by John King in his book that's a response to John Allegro's Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. John King is an example of how society found itself confronted with the choice of either heading towards the maximal entheogen theory of religion and adding drugs into popular Christian practice, or else running away from that direction of thinking and illegalizing all entheogenic knowledge of entheogen use in the history of religion. Entheogens were falsely diminished. The effect is that around the time that LSD was illegalized in the late 60s, society falsely diminished entheogens as a strategy, as a choice, because it was forced to make a choice. You've either got to head towards the maximal entheogen theory or else suppress it. Society chose to suppress it. entheogens were falsely diminished in order to save and preserve and protect the bunk status quo in late modern era religion, mythography, mysticism, meditation, and theology. That was a point that is often left out of a discussion of ego-death theory. In a discussion of the ego-death theory, it's important to keep in mind, if not discuss, the heavy media filtering effect of prohibition, where you only are permitted to see one certain view, and the other views are suppressed very effectively, silently suppressed, thus building up in the public mind a false selective picture that is completely false. Western esotericism. In discussing the ego-death theory, you have to point out that Western esotericism was understood as psychoactive plants into the early modern era. Western esotericism primarily includes, first of all, alchemy, mystic astrology, and magic. In all myth in antiquity, the serpent, including in the Garden of Eden, was understood as fatedness, one's preset world line constituting one's entire life. Thus, like all initiates, Adam and Eve began with the delusion of free will, but were led by the fatedness serpent, which is to say by determinism, predestination, or destiny, to consume the entheogen. This is relevant in the discussion of the rebellion against God in the Garden of Eden and God's foreknowledge and the death or debatable death or non-death of Adam and Eve in the garden upon eating of the apple. God said they would die, the serpent said they would not die, they had ego death. There are good passages about this, about the serpent being hymarmony or fatedness, in my main ego-death article. Legitimate theology is conducted under the psychoactive comprehension of the ins and outs of such quasi-paradoxical themes as dying and yet not dying, or being guilty of thinking that you had free will when in fact you were determined, and so you're punished for being predetermined to think that you had free will. Those kinds of quasi-paradoxical themes are properly covered only if you use legitimate theology, which is theology conducted under the full understanding of psychoactive initiation. We should assume that theologians prior to the modern era understood these mysteries or pseudo-paradoxes. The theologians understood these mysteries as themselves being initiates. These theologians were initiates and they were masters of myth themes, including free will and determinism myth themes, and having to do with transcending determinism. The original sin is that you think of sin in a certain way as though you're a free will agent. The Jesus figure and other New Testament themes were a polemical rebuttal to the Roman imperial ideology and claims. That's left out all the time. Now that's becoming a mainstream view in scholarship on Christian origins. That's a fast up-and-coming view there, and it needs to be brought in. But even as I say it needs to be brought in, I have to hammer on those scholars constantly, don't forget entheogenic mystic metaphor, including, particularly in Christian origins, the figure of the king on the cross as the supposedly autonomous control agent, experientially seeing determinism and then transcending it. A discussion of the ego-death theory that focuses on historical Jesus and his evidence for his historicity. Regarding Jacques de Molay, regarding the Turin Shroud, first of all, I'd point out against the implications of Max freakout in the Psychonautica episode 11. What is the official view of Christian apologists on the Turin Shroud? They tiptoe around it. It's a rather hot potato issue that is felt to be best avoided. So it was interesting and surprising to me that Max freakout dragged out the Turin Shroud as the best evidence for the historical existence of Jesus, because that move is very much not done. That you don't do that move. You're not allowed to make that move in conventional Christianity. The church and the establishment organizations are very much, very pointedly agnostic on, is Jesus shown in the shroud? And if so, does it show a dead man or a live man? There are three candidates for who's shown in the Turin Shroud. Which candidate is the least unlikely? Jesus is highly unlikely because the whole Jesus story in the New Testament doesn't make sense when interpreted as showing literal historical individuals. Leonardo da Vinci is unlikely to be the man in the shroud. What would Leonardo da Vinci be doing with all these cuts and wounds and things? That doesn't make any sense. Technically, there's some merit to saying it was Leonardo, but what would Leonardo da Vinci be doing with all these wounds? That doesn't make any sense at all. Jacques de Molay, persecuted by the Catholic Church, that makes sense. That is the least problematic of the three candidates. in which case the date of the Turin Shroud becomes far later than the conventional dating of it back to the year 30. Instead, it becomes 1200 or 1300. Then as soon as you say that, with such a late dating for the Shroud, you can hardly say that without mentioning Edwin Johnson's theory that the years 700 to 1400 didn't exist, so that all or many themes of New Testament Christianity, or many themes of popular Christianity at least, were a recent literary fabrication. He says the earliest date that we can at all trust is 1450 or so. I translated his book from specialist 1890s British version of English into comprehensible contemporary English. His book is called Pauline Epistles Explained. The recent theory that Paul was entirely fictional, along with, of course, Paul and the disciples such as Peter and John, Mary Magdalene. The whole origins of the New Testament don't make sense unless you consider all of these people to be fictional and controverted, politically, sociopolitically controverted figures, that there was a tug of war between competing camps to make Paul say this or make the Paul figure say this other thing instead. Kenneth Tupper very impressed me when, after a couple of years I had been asking him, maybe a few years I had been asking him to cover this idea that Paul was entirely fictional. And when Ken finally turned his attention to that at JesusNeverExisted.com, he did a surprisingly good job at covering it, because he had nothing on the subject. And I think it really shows the merit of Ken Tupper's critical view that he was able to kind of almost snap his fingers and overnight extend his critical view, his way of thinking, to questioning the historicity of Paul. Also consult and mention Hermann Dietering's book, The Fabricated Paul, which focuses mostly on the inauthenticity of all the epistles, but also is pretty clear that, I don't know if he really says Paul didn't exist, but he certainly says that Paul was Marcion, if anyone. Max Reiser in the 1970s wrote two books that highlight, I think that they highlight the direction of the spread of Christianity from Rome and Asia Minor and Alexandria, eventually to Jerusalem, where it didn't really catch on very well, rather than conventional Eusebian model, which shows Christianity in a Big Bang fashion, starting in Jerusalem and spreading to Rome and Alexandria from there. Also see Daryl Doty's article, Pauline Paradigms, which the focus of that article that makes it particularly valuable is his discussion of how paradigms work and assumption sets. At the beginning and ending of my interview with Psychonautica, it should be... Well, there's two things to mention, is how to donate to the drug policy reform organizations. And again, I hate the phrase drug policy reform. I think it's part of the problem. And also mention praying to the compassionate hidden controller of one's thoughts. If you're having a panic attack, pray to the controller. If you're having a control seizure, pray to the controller. That's a point regarding safety. This is a commentary on the song by Max Frost. There's a new sun, that's the next day after a trip. There's a new voice crying, we're not afraid to die. We're talking about ego death. The old world is people who aren't enlightened. Nothing can change the shape of things to come. This song acknowledges the existence of changes, of change, but portrays them as already existing in the future, lying ahead on your world line. There are changes ready and waiting on every road. Now, every road, any given road would be one individual's life or serpent-shaped world line. There are changes lying ahead on that road already. There are changes lying ahead on every road. There are new thoughts ready and waiting to explode. These are your own thoughts in the near future, sitting up ahead on your world line, ready. New thoughts sounds good and positive, but they are ready and waiting to explode. So these are explosive thoughts that are already set in your future. There are new thoughts, ready and waiting to explode, when tomorrow is today. When tomorrow is today has two meanings. One is that you're tripping during the night, and so the next day arrives during that session. And it also refers to how all times become connected together and equally nearby and timeless. The bells may toll for some. That alludes to ego death. But nothing can change the shape of things to come. Nothing can change the shape of things to come. Things to come are things, events in the future, including particularly thoughts lying along your control path, along your future. Nothing can change the shape of those. So the shape of those things is already laid out unchangeably in the future. The future is unchangeable, preset, pre-existing. The future is coming in now, sweet and strong. Ain't no one gonna hold back the future for long. So it says the future is coming. So you're sitting there and the future is arriving of its own accord from the point of view of subjective consciousness in the dissociative state. And no one's going to hold it back. Why would you want to hold it back? Well, apparently you want to hold it back because there's thoughts coming that are going to explode. And they're exciting because they're revolutionary thoughts, but also they're frightening. And if you want to hold them back, you can't. The emphasis here is not so much on the particular thought, so much as your inability to hold them back. That's really the explosive thought right there, is your inability to hold back the thoughts in your near future that are approaching of their own accord, it would seem, on your world line. The old realities is your old egoic way of thinking. The new dreams is the intuition of transcendent mental model. And it's coming in and crowding out the old egoic way of thinking. It's the revolution in your mind. Now, as an audio test, live guitar.